Support for WVIK comes from Kathleen Collins at the Dragonfly in Bettendorf. Using both conventional and alternative counseling methods for empowerment to help create change for individuals and couples. More information is at KathleenCollinsCounseling.com.
You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and well, all the ballots have been cast and counted, and we have winners for president, Senate, the House, right on down the line. We had a very, very important election this week, and it's time to kind of pick it apart and figure out what happened. A lot of analysis is going on around the country, and I'm very pleased to have with me today one of the best analysts in the country on elections, and he's Jacob Rubashkin, who's been on my show before. In fact, he did a election preview back earlier in the fall, I believe. Jacob's the deputy editor with Inside Elections, and he's going to be with us today to unpack the results. Jacob, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's just start with the presidential race. Just kind of give us a 40,000-foot view. What happened and why?
Well, Trump won, so we can get that out of the way real quick here. And he won by winning all seven, it looks like, of the key swing states that we were watching prior to Election Day. So the three Rust Belt states, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and then North Carolina, Georgia, Arizona, and Nevada. The election was close, but because Trump won all of the swing states, it doesn't look close in the electoral margin. And that, I think, is the source of a lot of the confusion or perhaps even shock about the results of the election, was that on paper, this looks like a pretty big win for Trump. And it was. But if you drill down into the specific election results, he won by 2 points in Pennsylvania and 1 point in Michigan and less than a point in Wisconsin and 2 points in Georgia and 2 points or 3 points in North Carolina and maybe 3 points in Nevada and 5 points. We'll see. It'll probably come down a little bit in Arizona. So close margins in all of those states, just close margins that favored Trump.
That seems to be what one thing that people were surprised that that he swept all seven of the battleground states. Polls were close. All the polls seemed close at the end. But again, I think people don't understand some of the intricacies of polling and the margin of error. You might talk about that a little bit and what you thought. I mean, the chances, what were the chances of one candidate kind of just taking all those states at the end when I think a lot of people thought they might be divided up a little bit?
Yeah, so every poll comes with a margin of error, which is the statistical measure within the poll of the certainty that given the sample size and the universe and the methods, you know, that you can be confident that a poll is reflecting a result within a particular range, which is it's a complicated way of thinking about it, but essentially a margin of error is a built into every poll, depending on how large it is, that says, look, we're giving you a number, but what we're really confident is that we're giving you a range. And so the polls were all close, and because they were so close, that range of confidence spanned both a Trump victory and a Harris victory, because most of the polling that we're looking at is margins of error of between 3 and 5 percentage points. There are also things that increase error beyond kind of the standard margin of error in polling, things like non-response error, which is this question of whether you're even able to get a representative sample, which is an increasingly difficult question in politics and in polling. So the true error of polls is probably a little higher than the margin of error. But to your other question, what we've seen is that results are correlated across states. States don't hold these elections in vacuums. They are all taking place in the same context as each other. And because those states are similar, because Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania have similar populations, have similar geographic concerns, because Arizona and Nevada have similar populations, similar geography, because North Carolina and Georgia have similar populations, similar geography, we can expect that they're more likely to move together than they are to diverge wildly. And so I said earlier on and going into this presidential election that it was more likely that either Harris or Trump swept all seven of those states than it was for them to break out in weird combinations. So even though it was close, even though either candidate had a high probability of winning, the most likely outcome was always going to be a pretty sizable electoral college majority, because if you're winning one of these states, you're winning the other ones as well, because, you know, it doesn't stop at the border, the trends that contribute to a candidate's win or loss.
Interesting. It appears right now as though Donald Trump will win the popular vote, which I think surprised a lot of people. But what was really significant in what we've seen in some exit polling and some other analysis of the results is he made inroads, not just in rural counties, which is his base, but in suburbs and even big cities and across demographic groups. Talk a little bit about what you've seen so far in breaking out the numbers again by region, but also all the different demographic groups.
The popular vote margin is probably the most surprising thing about this election. I do anticipate that will come down as more votes are counted in California. There's still probably 6 or 7 million votes left to count in California. Those will skew toward Harris. There are votes left to count in Oregon State, in Washington State, in Arizona. So I do expect that the overall popular vote margin will tighten. The kind of the Trump plus four number that we're seeing right now is going to get smaller, but there is a real chance that Trump carries the popular vote. And that is something that is less expected, simply because no Republican has carried the popular vote since George W. Bush in 2004. And he was the only person to do it since 1988 when his dad won against Michael Dukakis. So Trump would only be the second Republican to win the popular vote in over 40 years, right? Almost 40 years. So pretty stunning if that holds true. And the reason why he is in position to do that is, like you said, his strength among typically Democratic constituencies. So one of the things that we saw that really surprised us was his strength in deep blue states. Trump only lost New Jersey by 4 points. This is a state that voted for Joe Biden and Barack Obama by, you know, 15, 16, 17 points, voted for Hillary Clinton by a similar margin in 2016. Trump only lost New York by about 11 points. He only lost Illinois by 9 points. These are Democratic bastions that Trump did very well in the popular vote in. And he did so off the strength of increasing margins in the rural counties, which we all expected, but also by increasing his support in urban centers and kind of staunching the bleeding in the suburbs. So specifically among Hispanic and Latino communities, if you look at the counties that are predominantly Hispanic and Latino, you will see some of the largest shifts from 2020 to 2024. We are still digging through the more general demographic data of the election. We have information sources from exit polls that were conducted on Tuesday and before. Those are not final. and they are not always the most reliable. It will be several months before we have truly reliable data on the shape of the electorate. But what we do know from some of the results that we do have and looking at, you know, particular enclaves around the country is that Trump clearly did much better among Hispanic and Latino voters. Among Black voters, I think he ultimately ran pretty close to where he was in 2020. But the most interesting thing to me in all of this is that this does look like the first election cycle that the electorate was whiter than the previous cycle. So America has been on this very stable trend line for several decades, in which every year white voters make up a smaller share of the electorate relative to non-white voters. And that does not look like it happened this year. The share of voters who are white actually looks like it may have ticked up. And that plays a big part in the story of the Trump victory.
Is that because of just higher white turnout, or is it a combination of higher white turnout and lower African-American and Latino turnout? Do you know that yet?
I don't think we know that yet. I would imagine it's a little bit of column A, a little bit of column B results in this kind of situation.
What do you think, Jacob, caused this? I mean, again, I think there was an expectation this thing was going to be close. I get what you're saying, that the odds of it going one way or the other makes sense. I kind of felt that too at the end. It wouldn't ultimately be close, that close in the Electoral College. But what caused this wave? And I don't want to say wave, that's too strong a word. But what caused this shift of it was, or this outpouring of support Trump had, again, across most demographic groups and regions?
Dissatisfaction with the ruling party. This is, to me, the story of this election is Americans deeply dissatisfied with the state of the country and taking it out on Biden and the Democrats who have run the government for the last 4 years. We have seen incumbents lose elections all across the world this past year, as higher prices, inflation, global instability have really weighed on voters' minds, not just American voters, but voters in almost every developed country that has held an election over the last 12 months. And America is, it looks like, no different. The reason why Harris lost looks like, because voters wanted a change. Voters didn't like the way things were going. And Harris was not able to make herself the change agent in this election. That space remained reserved for Donald Trump, despite the fact that he is a former president who has full control over the Republican Party by this point and has been the dominant figure in American politics for the last 8 years. Despite all that, he found a way to continue to exist as the change agent in the minds of American voters. And so when voters weren't happy with how things were going, they looked to Trump to change it. And they didn't ultimately hold it against him, all of the things that Harris tried to make campaign issues. And so that feeling of turning the page that Harris talked so much about, I don't think that voters bought it from her, but they still, for whatever reason, buy it from Trump.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. I'm your host, Robin Johnson. My guest today is Jacob Rubashkin, who's the deputy editor of Inside Elections, which is a nonpartisan online newsletter about politics at the federal and state level. Jacob, I consider one of the foremost experts on elections across the country. He's back. He's been on my show several times before, and he was here to give kind of a preview back earlier in the fall. We've been talking a little bit about what happened in the presidential race and why, maybe some of the slight surprises we saw. I want to turn to the Senate in some of our remaining time and hit a few topics, and maybe we'll come back to the presidential race. But where does that stand right now? I know the odds were because of Senator Manchin leaving, the odds were Republicans were going to take over. And I know we've had some late results come in and some undecided races. But where are we at right now, and how strong is this Republican majority going to be?
At the moment, Republicans look like they will head into the Senate with a pretty sizable majority. The AP has called 53 seats for Republicans. Most recently, Pennsylvania, where Senator Bob Casey, the Democrat, was hoping some late ballots would push him over Republican Dave McCormick, but it does not look like that will be the case. And Democrats currently in 45 Senate races are called or weren't up for election. There are two that are still outstanding, Arizona and Nevada. Democrats lead in both, but those races are uncalled. So Republican majority looks like it will be at least 53-47, if not as great as 55-45 in the United States Senate.
Any surprises there that you saw that you felt like, you were surprised at the outcome?
I think Pennsylvania has to be considered the largest upset on the map. This was a race that Bob Casey started out very strong in. He is an institution in the state. His father was governor. He had won, three terms himself. And he had posted pretty significant polling leads earlier in the cycle against Dave McCormick, who had some vulnerabilities and lost a Republican primary last cycle to Dr. Oz. In the final polling averages, Casey was up by about 3 points, even as Harris was deadlocked in the state. And so for him to go down is certainly the most unexpected result. I mean, the other losses for Democratic incumbents in Montana and Ohio were more reasonable. Certainly in Montana, which is such a Republican state now, and in Ohio, which has become a Republican state, those candidates were always going to be highly vulnerable. But Casey, to me, is the big one. And then the sheer margins that we saw in a state like Texas, for instance, where Democrats yet again were pretty convinced at the end of that election cycle that they had put Texas firmly in play, and then for Trump to notch a 14-point victory in that state and Colin Allred not to come anywhere close to Ted Cruz, that really came as a surprise given how close Texas has been at the presidential and Senate levels over the last couple of years.
Let's turn our attention to the House. What's the latest you have there, and do you have a feeling on which side is going to ultimately gain control?
Republicans look like they are in slightly better position at this point to retain control of the House. It hasn't been called yet. There are still outstanding races across the board, but Republicans have to win fewer of those races than Democrats do in order to get to that 218 magic number. There are a lot of votes left to count in California, and there are six or seven highly competitive districts in California that could turn on those late results. So there's not a ton we can say about that, and there's the real potential for surprises. I wouldn't write Democrats off in the House entirely, but Republicans pulled out some good victories that have given them some breathing room. They flipped two Democratic-held seats in northeastern Pennsylvania. So Pennsylvania emerging as one of the brightest spots for Republicans this cycle. And they held on to one of their most vulnerable incumbents in Nebraska's second congressional district, Don Bacon, who was trailing in polling for much of this year. And even Republicans in Nebraska and nationally quietly acknowledged that this probably was the year that he would fail to meet the challenge. He looks like he will defeat his Democratic challenger. So some good news and unexpected results for Republicans that are keeping them in contention in the House. But we're looking at a very narrow majority either way. I mean, if Democrats take back the majority, it could be 218, 217. If Republicans maintain their majority, maybe they'll at best get to status quo 221, 214, but it's perfectly possible that they could also be in a 218, 217 or 219, 216 situation when the dust settles.
We had a couple very competitive races right here in the Quad Cities region, which we had discussed back last fall. And Marionette Miller Meeks, who won her first race by just a handful of votes, survived again. And Congressman Sorensen won with a little heftier margin. Any surprises there? Any comments on those races?
The Sorensen race never really came on board for Republicans. This was one that they were excited about earlier in the cycle. They felt they had a good candidate in retired Judge Joe McCraw, but he was not able to raise enough money to really take the fight to Sorensen. And look, Democrats in the Illinois state legislature did a very good job gerrymandering the map last cycle and giving Sorensen the kind of breathing room he needed to win that seat in that race that we saw in 2022, but then to hold on to it in 2024. You know, the Iowa district was an interesting one because when we made our final determinations on our ratings, we actually viewed Miller Meeks as the slight underdog in that race against Christina Bohannon. And ultimately, I think that it obviously it's a very close race. It looks headed for a recount. And Miller Meeks is up right now by a couple hundred votes. So you would rather be her than you would Bohannon. Ultimately, I feel good about where we landed there, though. I think we picked up on something that not a lot of other people saw, which was that Miller Meeks had a real problem, even though this district was more Republican than the other competitive Iowa district. We never... you know, the Iowa's third district, which was based in Des Moines on paper, looks like a better district for Democrats. But we were pretty sure by the end of the election that Zach Nunn, the incumbent there, was in much better shape than Miller Meeks was. So I think we picked on up on something that Miller Meeks is really struggling with. And if she wins, it'll be by that very, very narrow margin. If she loses, if Bohannon finds the votes to get across the finish line there, it would certainly be a boost for Democrats in their fight for the majority. But at the moment, it looks like Miller Meeks is going to escape another very, very close election.
I'm curious. I'm sure you were like me watching the election returns come in Tuesday night, maybe a bowl of popcorn, a couple TVs, a couple computers, your phone, checking things. But at one point, was there one point, Jacob, where you were like, okay, Trump's going to win and he's going to win and do as well as he did? Was there one indicator that tipped you off that this was going to be his night?
So I was working actually at the ABC News decision desk up in New York City, helping out call races in the House of Representatives. So I was looking at a whole bunch of data that was coming in the door. And, you know, I think that it was pretty clear early on in the evening that things were going to be very close. And then, you know, I think that I don't know if there was one particular moment when it became clear that Trump was going to win. But I think what we found was just that there were a lot of really close races in the House, at least, that were very difficult to call. And there were some Democrats who we thought might be a little bit more solid that were also in really tough races. And that, to me, was an indicator that, you know, we were seeing a slightly Republican favoring electorate. So when we saw somebody like Marcy Kaptur up in Toledo really struggle in her race, I think she's going to win, but it'll be very, very close. And she looked to be in better position heading into Tuesday. Again, when we saw those Pennsylvania races in Northeast PA look very, very tight and even favor the Republicans, that was just another signal. But you know, again, I think that the reality is we always knew that those seven core battleground states were going to be nail biters, and the shocks of the night came in places that nobody was really looking at, which was New Jersey, Illinois, Connecticut, blue states that swung very, very hard toward Donald Trump.
Final question. We just have a couple minutes left here. What a tumultuous year. Unpredictable, all the things that happened. right now, there's a lot of recriminations going around on the Democratic side. Of course, you had the sitting president fumble in the debate, dropped out under enormous pressure. The vice president came in, ran, what, a 3 or 4 month campaign, raised $1 billion. What's your, was this kind of predestined just because of the underlying economic conditions? Could Harris have done something different, or should the Democrats have gone to an open convention? Just if you could sum that up in a couple minutes, I'd appreciate it. Probably not a fair thing to ask, but give it a try.
I don't think that it was predetermined. I think that this was a close election and circumstances can change. Things can happen. I think that if elections were predetermined, certainly I would be out of a job, and I think a lot of people would be out of a job, and a lot of TV stations would probably go bankrupt. But I do think that the results underscore the fact that Democrats were the underdogs heading into this election. And that was absolutely the case when Joe Biden was the nominee. And if anything, I think there's some evidence to suggest that Harris was successful in campaigning her way out of what was a significant hole left by the Biden administration and the Biden campaign. And the reason I say that is because if you look at how the electorate moved in those core battleground states, it's actually much more minimal than it is in all of the places where Trump and Harris and Biden didn't campaign. So I think that is that's the real interesting data point to me, is that if you just look at blue states, the Harris's strength plummeted relative to Biden. If you look at red states, Harris's strength plummeted relative to Biden in 2020. And if you look at the battlegrounds, it went down, but it didn't go down by nearly as much. It was a much smaller delta just looking at those seven battlegrounds. And that to me suggests that the campaigning actually worked, because it made it an even closer election. But the environment and the circumstances were too great for Harris to overcome. So I'm not going to pretend to be smart enough to sit here and say, well, if she had only done this, or if she hadn't done that, then that would have been the difference maker. I don't believe that there is any one thing in this election that was the difference maker. And I think that it's too reductive to say that that is the case, especially in a race where we saw so many different groups, so many different geographies move against Harris. Again, there's really no group out there that did better for Harris than they did for Biden 4 years ago. That's not something that can just be explained by a different messaging tack or a different campaign schedule. That speaks to something more fundamental about how voters of all stripes were feeling heading into Tuesday.
Well, Jacob, thank you so much for taking the time. I know it's been a very busy week for you. And as always, some excellent analysis explaining to our listeners what happened and why. Jacob Babashkin with Inside Elections have been our guest today on Heartland Politics. Jacob, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. You can follow Heartland Politics at WVIK.org or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.